We're having some chats about the Old Testament. Just some thoughts as we try to pull together the great body of ideas and which form the foundation of our New Testament teachings. So we're trying to put all that together in a manageable form. Otherwise, you face the Old Testament as just a great mass of data. It looks almost like a formidable task to even get into it. So that's what we're trying to do, to extract from the Old Testament the essence of its ideas. And for a couple of weeks, we've kind of talked about the meaning of faith as it is applied to the Old Testament or to our Christian life in general. Because faith is a word that's so commonly kicked around. To most people, it's sort of a fuzzy feeling of loyalty to God, or usually an effort to muster up some kind of feeling, and an effort which doesn't often succeed because we are living in the world we do. We're naturally cynical. We don't have the security in our society that the average tribesman has in New Guinea or Africa or something, because tribal groups are great for security because they teach people a common culture and teach them roles. In the primitive tribes, roles are well-defined. People know what they're supposed to do, and those roles don't change from century to century even. But here in America, insecurity is our greatest malaise, I think, because everybody's on their own. Very few stop to think it might be well to get advice even from older people. They all want to make their own mistakes. By the time they've got through making all their mistakes, their life isn't together much, so then they spend the rest of their life in cynicism, you see, and insecurity. But we've gone down that road in our society and been quite careless and loose about the way we've held our mores and our customs together. Well, anyway, that's put us in a position where faith is a pretty difficult commodity to come by. We develop cynicism in our society. We don't expect a whole lot, usually. So it's necessary to understand what the essence of faith is in order to understand what our relationship to God is, because it's based on faith. That's what I've been trying to get at for the last couple of weeks, to give us a solid footing in the matter of faith, to give us something to hold on to, so that when we come across the word faith, or when we come across the interrelationship between God and others in the Old Testament, who would ever think they could bring water out of the rock, for example, like Moses did or anything? It almost takes on fairy tale proportions, most of the Bible. You see in the New Testament, Jesus working miracles and disciples working miracles and so forth. And not a whole lot of that happens with us. Then you get all the carnival stuff on TV, and that usually chalk up pretty much to showmanship, and you let it go at that. Well, I want this to be a viable thing with you, the connection between ourselves and God, and that's why I said, and took a considerable amount of time to try and put the ideas together, that our faith is like an energy process, originating with God and not with us. It's God's power or energy or whatever coming through us rather than something we conjure up in our brain in order to make contact with God. And I have to say that the things that the Lord wants us to do usually gives us the faith to do it. I only say usually because I'm not an absolutist, but I would say it's a fairly generally reliable truth that God gave Moses, for example, the faith to interact with him and take those people across the wilderness, where we might, if somebody handed you an assignment like that today, you might feel a little inadequate for it. Even if you had been a pioneer and you were handed the assignment to take 50,000 people across the plains you wouldn't figure you had the faith to do something like that, see? And I'm sure Moses did not feel he had the faith to do it either. When God tapped him for the job, or of course God had probably already planned this, but the time was ripe, Moses was not in a mood to do it, but God gave him the needed strength, the needed faith, as well as the needed bravado, if you will. It takes a lot of presumption to set out on a task like that. God gave Moses whatever he needed to do it. So at that point, Moses went down into Egypt, back to Egypt, and confronted the Pharaoh in a contest of wills that involved a very strongly miraculous process or procedure. Well, his herding of sheep for 40 years was not the typical prelude to a grand conquest like that. See, what I'm saying is that it wasn't that Moses was in seminary for 40 years getting ready to do this job or being trained in any particular way. He was just back there herding sheep. And now suddenly is confronted with a momentous task of standing up to the greatest monarch of the Middle East. And he did so without any, I was going to say without hesitation. I don't know whether he hesitated at all or not, but at least with complete success and with great boldness. You see, the Lord does not, as he says very clearly, call necessarily the strong, the mighty, the talented. He gives a person the gift to do what it is he wants him to do. And he gives it to him at the time he wants him to do it. A lot of the young men there in the seminary, or the institute, I should rather say, in the institute are not convinced that they're slated for any great leadership activities. I don't pay attention to that. I think that if the time came that the Lord had something for him to do, he'll give him the strength to do it. Until that time, there's no use charging them up with a lot of energy that they will just dissipate anyway, playing basketball. You know. No use getting them all charged up here. I think it's a great mistake in schools where they forever trying to get the guys all and people all charged up to be grand servants of God. The problem is it's better for them to kind of stay steady until they get themselves ready. Then they can be charged up if they want to be, if the Lord wants them to be. So anyway, looking at this whole process through the Old Testament, it's very vital for us to understand the issue of faith, because that was the fundamental essence of what was the motivating force of all that went on in the Old Testament. And it was just a constant point all through the Old Testament. The constant point was that each of these heroes, if we may call them, of the faith, each of these important figures had a pretty similar experience. They were people that were more or less not outstanding people, but God tapped them to do a job, and when he tapped them to do the job, he gave them the strength to do it. I think in a lot of respects today, people may shoot out beyond their strength because they're goaded on by the idea that big is better. And just like we're goaded on by the idea that the noisier something is, the more power there is there. Noise and size seem to be the hallmarks to us today of success. That was not true in terms of God's process in the Old Testament. What you get is that God quietly went about his task of working with the people. You know, he didn't make a lot of splash. Just quietly fulfilled his purpose. When his time came, at each point, when the time came for him to make certain movements within his among his people, he did it. When the time came for Abraham, for example, to leave Ur of the Chaldees and go over to Palestine, that's what took place. And we had no indication that Abraham had any very special commitment to God or consecration or anything. It was just that when God was ready to move, he put it in Abraham's heart to do it, and he did it. It was all from the Spirit of God and not from anything in the man himself. These were not, by and large, grand people. They were just commoners like ourselves through whom God worked. So you have your Joshuas and Gideons and Samsons and your Samuels and Elijahs and so forth. Just common, ordinary men. But in the hand of God, they were not ordinary. Just as Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 4, we have this treasure in earthen vessels, that the excellency of the power may be of God and not of us. So the vessel must be clay, that the glory may be God's. If there's too much glory in the vessel itself, then there's less glory for God. And you find in Christendom today grand figures, people that are great personalities and with charisma, sparkling entertainers and so forth. Everyone is awed by them. And in a lot of cases, and I'm not being judgmental here, but in a lot of cases, Christ doesn't really come through so much as the personality and the show that's there with it, you see. It's all a grand entertainment, more or less. I wouldn't say strictly entertainment, nor do I want to call it carnival, but I think there's a lot of the showmanship element in that. So, in a lot of cases, again, one doesn't look at these some of these figures today as men of God, shepherds of the people, so much as they look upon them as great figures, promoters, showmen. And so you lose the simplicity factor here. The fundamental thing we want to get across on that then is you go through the Old Testament. God quietly goes about doing what he wants to do, selecting his agents from the common people and imbuing them at the given time with the needed energy or power to accomplish the purpose he has set out for them. That gives us great encouragement, should give us a sense of security, because things have gone on in the world for many centuries, a great many centuries, in about the same way. Life goes on day in and day out. The various physical laws of the universe function in their way, and we function in our way, and we get up in the morning, and we do our chores and have our fascinations, and we go to bed. And life just goes on in this way. We couldn't really handle it, I think, if everything was always spectacular anyway. It's just simple and common. And I think Christian people do better functioning within that mold than trying always to be spectacular, always to have grand experiences. Yet, you know, in a lot of meetings, the emphasis is on grand experience. It's sort of a one-upmanship or an upstaging thing. Everybody has a grander story to tell, and it's spectacular and energizing and inspirational, all that, but in the long run, the day-by-day carrying on, doing our job and being at peace is what really counts. And the other kind of thing where our spiritual experience is always intense, see, in a lot of movements, spiritual experience is a constantly intensive thing. You've got to be doing something about it, you see. Up all the time and psychologically and just going at your life. All right, so you read the Old Testament, and whereas you have a number of figures in the Old Testament that are outstanding, the great masses of the people were simply members of the family of God. You can't stand too many bright lights anyway. You see, in the church today, I think we have that to face. That maybe not everybody is supposed to be a bright light. You know, maybe they're not supposed to have a whole assembly full of intense, grand, brilliant people. Maybe we just have to have people or sheep, and you have a few among them that are leaders. in that kind of a way, God gets more of the glory. Of course, the temptation is always in things that are more or less spectacular, where people have these grand experiences of healing and other things. The temptation is always there to sort of feel, well, even though we do say the Lord did it, we have to admit this person must have had a lot of faith. There's always that undercurrent of a sense that this person was better than we are, or we'd have had the same thing happen to us. And not too many people do anything to quell that feeling. But the person who has these grand experiences is a little better than the others. Now, looking at the story of the children of Israel, who happened to be the centerpiece of the Old Testament, and in fact, in some respects, of the New, but the centerpiece of the Old Testament was the Jewish nation. And God's dealings with that body of people make up the essence of the writings. In the New Testament, that God's dealings with the people in the body and the church, these are the centerpiece of the New Testament, really. Even then, the Jewish nation comes in for its share of attention, inasmuch as God had promised to deliver them as a nation and to bring them through in spite of all the problems. And this he did. That is to say, in the prophetic picture, Book of Revelation, for example, in the prophetic picture, God does accomplish what he had planned to do. But we have to wait for the future for that. Now, Moses comes down into Egypt to deliver the people. Now we're faced with this point, or this process. God has an agency through which he will make himself known to the world. That is, the Jewish people as a whole will be the more or less living evidence of God in the world. He will be known as the God of Israel or the God of Jacob. Whatever happens to the nation of Israel will reflect on God, will point to God. And through this group of people, God will bring to the world the specific revelation of himself. And when I say the specific revelation, I mean that whereas you can know that God exists through the creation, through the world around you, you can know that God is. To know what God is, you need a more specific revelation, and this the Bible gives us, through the Jewish nation. So they will be the channel of revelation or communication of God to the world. Well, now they're stuck in Egypt. They're slaves. It's almost as though God's message or messengers are imprisoned. It's as though Satan was tying up the messengers so that the message can't get out. God lets that go on for a while, but then comes the moment when he has to deliver them and does deliver them, and they come out of that prison house of Egypt. The conditions under which they have been working or living are pretty severe. They had come down in the beginning, in the early days, with Jacob. Jacob and his family had come down because there was a famine up in Israel, in Palestine. And as you remember, Joseph was now the prime minister of Egypt, and through Joseph, the whole nation of Egypt was preserved in the famine. Well, anyway, Joseph now is a very important figure in Egypt, so he sends for his family, his father and his brothers and sister, and they come down. They live up in Goshen, one section of Egypt. All right, well, then the years go by, and Joseph dies, and the pharaoh that knew Joseph dies, and other pharaohs come along. And so now for 400 years, the children of Israel, as they would come to be known, the children of Jacob, were growing, multiplying up there in the land of Goshen. So finally they became rather a large body of people. Because you have 12 tribes and you have certain numbers from each tribe, and it wouldn't be very long before you'd have a 500,000 people up in Goshen. Well, it was enough that the Pharaoh was worried about them and brought them into a condition of servitude, of bondage. They constructed perhaps some of the buildings in Egypt, not the pyramids, but possibly the Temple of Karnak up the Nile River. They probably had a hand in that. But anyway, be that as it may, they did help with the construction of these buildings. But they were 400 years in this period of bondage. In that length of time, one would assume that they had had their day, you know, that their number was up, that they were not going to do anything more than just spend the rest of the centuries grinding out the buildings for Egypt. That's 400 years, a long time. Even it'd take Moses' 40-year period back in the wilderness. If you spent 40 years in a given situation, you would assume pretty well that that was going to be the rest of your life. And Moses must have assumed that he would never be anything more than a sheep herder out there in the desert. But God has a timing factor, you see, and his time timing is not our timing. Now, I presume Satan felt that he had now effectively and irrevocably bottled up the message that was going to go out to the world about God. It would be as though all the Christians in Los Angeles were put into concentration camps or something. Then you would assume that the message of that body of believers was pretty well over. At any rate, they were down in Egypt for a long time and then were finally delivered. There are those that use Egypt as a symbol of the world. The simple Sunday school scenario here is that Egypt is a type of the world, and that they trek across the wilderness, which is a type of the, or a symbolic of the earthly pilgrimage, and then they arrive in the promised land, which almost universally in the church is regarded as a type or symbol of heaven, right? The promised land. Is not this the land of Beulah and so forth? And people talk about crossing the Jordan and so forth, you know, when they're going to go to their reward. But as I've often pointed out, there's one big problem with that symbol, that type. There were giants in the land. The enemy was there. Now, you're not going to have the enemy in heaven. See, you can't have it as a type of that. What we rather would have to say is that Egypt is a type of a nation controlled by Satan. And the Pharaoh, one of Satan's agents. It was obvious that the Pharaoh was taking his orders from Satan, especially when he ordered all the children of the Israelites, the boy, the firstborn, or the all the boy babies to be slain. So you're talking about not the world per se. We're not talking about a condition of non-salvation versus salvation. You can't say that Egypt is a type of the world of unbelievers and that coming out of Egypt's type of being saved. Not at all. You have to see Egypt as a type of Satan's kingdom and the bondage of the children of Israel in Egypt, a type of Satan's bondage over God's people until he releases them. Only God can release them. God comes and in a miraculous way through the agency of Moses persuades finally the Pharaoh to let the people go, and Moses becomes in a sense a type of Christ, the deliverer. Not so much the individual deliverer to salvation, but the deliverance of the people of God or the people of the world from Satan's bondage. You might say that the desert represents the struggles of the children of Israel per se, whereas the promised land represents the New Testament kind of deliverance of salvation as such. Promised Land really represents in type probably salvation per se, whereas the trek across the desert represents God's dealings with his own people in the years before the coming of Christ. In all events, without it being necessary to really pin down the types, the overall pattern, which we can pretty well nail down, is that God's people function in a very hostile world. Whether you're talking about the wilderness of Sinai, you're talking about Palestine itself with the enemy in there, the Canaanites and the Moabites and various enemies, or you are talking about the struggles of believers in the world today in this century, whatever you're talking about, the one thing that is clear is that the people of God are in an enemy territory. They're in a hostile world. And the only way that they can survive is by the power of God. And it becomes quite evident because out in the wilderness, out in the Sinai Desert, they're out of water. Well, you have 500,000 people in a Death Valley type of wilderness. Finding water for them is a problem. And food for that many people out on the desert, that's a problem. Jesus in the New Testament fed 5,000, and that is regarded as an extremely magnanimous miracle. God, on the other hand, fed 500,000 out in the wilderness, and we might look upon that as also fairly miraculous. In other words, the message is clear that Satan exercises a considerable amount of power in this world, and that our only hope of deliverance is through allegiance to Christ. When we are in allegiance to Christ, we will confront a number of problems. Satan will be hot on our trail. We will have our struggles and our failures often. But in the end, we will prevail. And God will prevail in the world, even ultimately in setting up a kingdom for Israel. So the promised land, per se, probably more represents God's ultimate giving of the kingdom to Israel, or restoration of the kingdom to Israel. Israel is supposed to have the kingdom. Palestine is supposed to be given to Israel as a permanent dwelling place. Apparently, from what the Bible says, there's going to be an earthly kind of kingdom and a heavenly kingdom, and that Palestine and Israel will have that. Well, that will be the central factor, at least, in the earthly kingdom. So we may not even have to go beyond Israel itself to find our symbolism in the land of promise, because God is going to use that ultimately for His own people anyway. The comfort we can take tonight from the study of the Old Testament is that God was very much in evidence, and that though His people were very weak and were frequently in bondage in one way or another, nevertheless, God delivered them and brought them through to great fulfillment. He brought them into their land, and whereas they later lost that land, He does ultimately intend to restore it to them. They're in there now, but I'm not sure how successfully or permanently, because there is not, along with the restoration of the land to the people, there's not a concurrent restoration of faith. You know, they're not that much revived as far as their spiritual nature is concerned. That's one of the major accompaniments of the restoration of the kingdom in Israel, is the restoration of their spirits. This makes a very interesting analogy for us, and I think brings the Old Testament to life. It isn't a matter of saying, although it may be true, but it's not the primary symbolism of the Old Testament characters was not that since God brought water out of the rock for His people in the wilderness, He's going to bring food and sustenance to us. He does sustain us, yes, but that isn't the major thrust of the Old Testament to show how neat things the Lord does for us when we're in difficulty. He does good things when we're in difficulty. He helps us, but that's not our fundamental basis for believing that. We have other bases for believing that He helps us. Well, again, we can be comforted in the security of things. Not the security of saying that everything in our lives is going to be grand and God will correct every ill and solve every problem. Not that. There are a lot of problems in life that are not resolvable. Just take even the matter of marriage, for example. A great many Christian people that I deal with, I got married before they became Christians. Now, they did not obviously ask God's guidance for whom they should marry. Now they have certain problems in their lives, problems between them, that are based upon personality differences, which had they been with Christ and had they sought counsel, they would probably have been advised not to get married. You see, in other words, the one marries the wrong person. Well, now there are certain problems connected with that marriage that will be unresolvable as long as the marriage lasts, and it won't be resolved by, you know, you could resolve it by divorce, but that doesn't really solve the problem at all. What I'm saying is certain things that we have acquired to ourselves prior to coming to Christ may affect our lives to the point that there is no easy solution. I talked just as recently to a person, Christian man, with that very problem. Here's a situation in which it's quite likely or quite possible he should never have gotten married to this person, see? Because problems have evolved that are not ever going to really be solved apart from splitting up, which I, you know, he's not about to do that, we're not recommending it. But I'm saying to you that in terms of a lot of problems that we confront, there are problems that are simply not going to be resolved as long as we're on this earth. We might as well get used to that. The children of Israel going across the desert didn't have a free ride. I mean, it wasn't a grand safari with plenty of sustenance and beverages and food for everyone. It wasn't a truck and trailer holiday trek, I'll tell you that. These people suffered. They had a problem in the desert. They were almost certain they were going to die of thirst many times, and they were hungry. And a lot of things that were a problem in that trek across the wilderness. They didn't jump on the big bus and run across the desert in an air-conditioned coach. what I'm saying is that in this life on the earth for ourselves, it isn't an air-conditioned ride. There are going to be many bumps and problems and bruises, and they're not going to be resolved this side of heaven. But the moment you settle down to that, you don't look for an easy life. That is, you don't look for God to sweep away all the problems so you can have a nice life. I've used the analogy of the football field in this many times. In the first place, I'm saying that in a football game, there are problems from the moment you step on the turf till you step off again. The entire game is one series of problems. There were no game if there were no problems. So you don't go to the coach and say, "Hey, coach, you know, I thought we were going to have a leisure time in this. Every time I turn around, somebody's hitting me." No, that's the problems are from one end of the game to the other. I mean, from the beginning of the game to the end, there are problems. But by the same token, nobody suggests that if you'd get that bunch of 11 gorillas out of the way, we could make some touchdowns. That's the game, obstacles. Well, that's what the life here in the earth is all about. It's obstacles. There's no use to try to get all the obstacles brushed out of the way so you can have a nice life. That's not what it's all about. So you'll struggle. But by the same token, the struggles come within the capacity to handle them. They come a day at a time, two or three times a day perhaps, but, you know, they're measured out to a degree. So, at any rate, the thing Christ gives us is the capacity to cope with a problem. Not just with he doesn't give us the solving of the problem so much as the capacity to cope with a problem. Some things he solves and some he doesn't, but the basis on which he solves problems for us is not simply the fact that if we have enough faith, we're going to have an easy time of it. That's the way a lot of people seem to teach it. If you have enough faith, you're not going to have any problems. Well, I think we better stop here. Father, we ask you to take these words now and minister to us through them according to your will. Bring to bear upon our spirits those thoughts and ideas that you have in mind. In Christ's name, amen.